Hey, gang, I want to tell you about True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. They are fantastic. I've been using them now for a couple of months. I've used their balms. I've used their oils to sleep. And today, I'll be talking about a whole new product. Now, listen, True Hemp Science promises you premium quality, pure ingredients, and true value. They source the highest grade organic hemp from around the world to handcraft the finest full spectrum CBD products. They offer a complete line of CBD products, including full spectrum CBD oils, tinctures, CBD skincare lotions, CBD sports rubs, CBD gummies, and CBD gluten-free chocolates. They number their CBD products to differentiate them by strain, by farm, and by extraction method. Now, last week I was telling you about the number 81, which is great for relaxation and sleep. But today I'm going to be talking to you about number G41. That's full spectrum CBG plus CBDA plus terpenes. Now, this has given me some focus. It has some CBD in it, but it doesn't make you sleepy or tired or foggy in any way. The CBG kind of gives you some focus and it energizes your brain while keeping you calm and cool. You know what I'm saying? People report it relaxes their brain and does not affect cognitive performance. While it is calming, it is less physically so than CBD. It's great for working. It's great for getting your work done. I'm even using it right now. So, gang, how did I get here as partnered with True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products? And if you use the code HDIGH, you will get something special. Purchase $65 worth of regular price products and receive 296 milligrams of number 81 distillate. That's the one I was telling you about. That's great for rest, relaxation, and sleep. Just go to truehempscience.com/HDIGH. For how did I get here? And you can also visit them at their brick and mortar store. That's right. They have a physical location right here in Austin at 505 West Mary Street, Unit C, Austin, Texas. Don't forget, use the code HDIGH. If you're already using CBD products, switch over to this one. I promise it's going to be great. You're going to love it. All of these products are great. And the CBG, CBDA is unbelievable. Like, I'm telling you, I feel very clear. I feel very focused. I haven't been drinking a bunch of coffee all day, and I'm not all anxious from coffee. You know what I'm saying? TrueHempScience.com, HDIGH. You're not only getting yourself some CBD, but you're helping us out here, right? By using the code HDIGH. TrueHempScience.com. Go get your full spectrum CBD products today. Let's get down. Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a good weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. I had a weekend. Started off good on Friday. I hosted that Lush Life event at Pershing. That was a lot of fun. I want to thank Zach Scott and James Robinson and Sean Barnes for having me out to host it. It was a lot of fun. There was great sets by James Robinson, Grace Sorensen, Harry Adokwa, and a DJ set by Magna Carta. They were playing the whole night, playing in between the sets. It was a lot of fun hosting the event. It was great getting to see these acts. It's always great getting to see James Robinson. I've never seen him do the same thing twice. It's always some kind of, like, we talked about it during that podcast. Like, what he does is, like, it's like a jazz performance thing. It's the style of music isn't necessarily. I mean, there's flavors of it in there, but it's in the spirit of a jazz performance thing where, like, you're doing it. And it's a fleeting experience, and it's not going to happen again, so you got to be engaged while it's happening. And he's really great at engaging, you know, just the way he does it is great. He had a big band this time. It was the first time I ever got to see Grace Sorensen and Harry Adokwa, both incredible sets. Harry's set was really great, man. He's a rock star. And that Grace Sorensen, I can't believe she's just 19. Like, she owned that stage, and her music is sublime, sublime. It's very still. It's very cool. She's got a lot of cool for someone that's just 19, you know? She's got a lot of layback. So I'm going to try and get Harry and Grace on the show. You'll hear from them. Anyway, great time doing that Lush Life event. You can follow those guys on Instagram at lushlife.live. That's where you can find them on Instagram. Find out. Their next show is March 25th. I think it's at Pershing, so So gang, I got to talk about this because I've had a weird week. Last week, let me go back a few years. There's a guy that's a fan of Skyrocket. He's a fan of mine. He's a fan of this podcast when there's artists that he likes on here. Very vocal about when he doesn't like artists, at least privately to me. And he would write me all the time on a regular basis, like one of those fans that really feels like he needs to kind of connect with you on almost a daily basis. In some way. So there was a lot of messages back and forth over the years, a lot of like, you know, talking to him at the shows and getting these messages and him suggesting bands for the podcast and suggesting bands that I check out and all this kind of stuff. Generally, a nice guy, but a very uncomfortable guy. There was a level of desperation to his approach that was a little unsettling as an artist. So, you know, through the years, I kept him at arm's length. So he wrote me a lot. And back in October, at the end of October, he wrote me that he was coming to a winery show that Skyrocket was playing, but that he was having troubles with his wife and that they were going through some difficult times and that she wanted to leave him. And he didn't know what he was going to do. And he didn't have a lot of people to talk to. And again, not to be a bad person, and I feel a little bad about this, but I was like, man, I'm really sorry. That's a tough situation to be in. I didn't really know what to say, and I didn't want to engage too much because this guy, again, there was a very uncomfortable sort of vibe about him. Even though he wasn't mean, or he was just very aggressive in his communications. I don't know if that's a way to describe, if you understand what I'm saying. Anyway, then I hadn't heard from him since I saw him at that show, at that winery show back in November, like the beginning of November. And I noticed last week, I was like, man, I haven't heard from that guy in a long time. So I went and looked at our messages and I realized that I had sent him an invitation to this live stream I'd done a few weeks ago. And he never responded. He never even looked at it. And I was like, that's weird. Wonder if he's like boycotting me for something. Because there were a couple times during the he was a very heavy right-wing Republican. And if certain things happened in my podcast or something, he would tell me he was taking a break from me, that he didn't like my whatever, but he still liked my music and respected me as an artist. Anyway, so I go and look at his page, and then I see an artist that I know is a mutual friend of ours, and I click. I notice that he hasn't posted anything since like January, which is weird, because he's a guy that posts a lot. He's retired. Sorry, this story is so long. Anyway, so then I see the musician who's a mutual friend of ours, and I'm like, oh, I've heard of that guy. I click on his thing, and I see that he had played a memorial for this fan and his wife. So he and his wife were dead. I was like, what happened? So I went and I looked, I found this obituary and it talked about how they had the same birthday and they got married on their birthday and that they actually died on the same day. And then I saw some people post on stuff on social media saying that it was a tragedy. And I was like, well, what happened? And so with some digging, I found out that it was a murder-suicide. And I don't know exactly who did what to who or what happened, but it was shocking. It was really fucking shocking to me. It took me out of the game for a couple of days. Like in my head, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I had I should have maybe reached out to him, but like what could I have done? You know what I mean? What could I have said to him that would have stopped this sort of thing? And would he have opened up to me about this? It seems like he shut down for a while, and at least did to me too. That was a weird thing, but it sent me on this thing thinking about people's mental health over the last couple of years. And I know that he was going through a hard time during the 2020. He was having a difficult time with masks. He was having a difficult time with venues not being open, all the stuff that happened that people were angry about. He was very angry about it. And I noticed when I was looking up murder-suicide, that there were just a lot recently, like an inordinate amount of, like over the last week, you know what I mean? Just in Texas alone, there've been a bunch, like a scary amount. And it made me realize that over the last couple of years, people's mental health has really taken a dive. my own too. Like I've had my dark days and I've had my bummer days, not just about, you know, chicks and stuff, but like about, you know, just about life. What's happening? What's going to happen? Our world has changed. It's a different place. Now things are becoming really unaffordable. It's frightening and it's a scary time. So basically what I'm trying to get at is if you feel yourself slipping in the mental health area, do something. Reach out to somebody. Reach out to a friend if you can. Reach out to a family member if you can. There's a lot of different resources online that you can reach out to, and people that are there to talk and to listen. Listen, you know, we all need someone to listen to us. All right, so that's my thing for the day. I just wanted to let you guys know it was a weird. It's been a weird week. I'm still a little weirded out by it, but for a couple of days, I was really just kind of in shock, and then just kind of in shock at the bigger picture of what's happening to our society, and I mean, you know, look, I'm not laughing. It's happening in our neighborhood. It's happening in my apartment complex. It's happening everywhere. So get help if you can. Reach out to someone who cares if you can. All right. Mental health, man. It's definitely at a critical point right now. So get help. All right, gang. I have a great show for you guys today. All right. My friend Alex Vallejo, creative director at School of Rock, South Park Meadows, and Round Rock, and my old friend Bevis Griffin from Devoir Apex Solutions have teamed up to create a program School of Rock is a music school. It's not just a movie. It's a music school. They're all over the country. There's a national chain, but the ones in South Park Meadows and the ones in Round Rock are owned by the same company, Rockin' D5. And the creative director is my friend Alex Vallejo, and they teach music. And in this world of like teaching rock and stuff like that, we're starting to realize that there's a part of the story that's been left out. It doesn't start with the Rolling Stones or Elvis, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, and Guns N' Roses. Like that's where the rock comes from. It starts from a deeper place. And so Bevis Griffin, along with some other great, great folks, including his sister associated with the Devoir Apex Solutions, have developed the Deep Roots of Rock and Blues program, which is being implemented now at School of Rock at South Park Meadows and Round Rock. So my guests today are Alex Vallejo from the School of Rock and my friend Bevis Griffin from Devoir Apex Solutions. And they're getting together and they're teaching kids that there's more to rock than just Elvis, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, and Guns N' Roses. Not that they're not great, but they all came from a place like Robert Johnson, Sister Rosa Tharpe, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. They're here to create a deeper understanding of African-American cultural contributions to the evolutions of rock and roll. So Bevis and Alex and I have a great conversation about this very thing and about the program that they're implementing and why it's so important to look back and get the actual history of rock and roll. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Alex Vallejo and Bevis Griffin. Let's get down.
Back for a second, do the math, what's the lesson, where we are, where we
I got my coffee. So I saw you guys on TV. I think it was on KXAN.
Yeah, dude, we're on a media blitz. It's yeah. I think we've been on KVU, KXAN, Fox. I mean, Adrian's really been out there just kicking ass. You know, I think we have it's a good story. I mean, it's what we're doing right now, man. It's pretty cool. So
do you want to go ahead and tell us? I'm Alex, this is Alex Vallejo. Both of you guys, Bevis as well. Who wants to go ahead and kind of start telling the story of this?
Let Alex set the table because I'm long winded. So you better give
him. Yeah, once he starts, go ahead and start. No, man. I mean, you know, this is something that we've been working on for a while. I mean, you know, Bevis was introduced to me by Jennifer, actually, from Awesome Music Foundation, because you know. Bevis had done the 28 days of Bevis,
right?
AMF. So, you know,
you were actually on the show last year talking about that. Sorry, go ahead.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I was introduced by, through Jen, to Bevis, and we got jumped on a call and we started, you know, immediately hit it off and just started talking about things that, you know, that obviously what I was already aware of what he was doing with AMF, but, you know, he, in the process, he had been approached by a School of Rock corporate, you know, to take on this initiative within this program that they were trying to do within, within School Rock. And I'll let Bevis speak a little bit more on that, but, we were introduced on that, and we, you know, we thought we'd hit the ground running, you know, while they try to figure out what they were doing more on the corporate level, that, you know, since Bevis was in town, that, you know, we would kind of hit the ground running here in town. I mean, it's low hanging fruit as far as, our schools being here in town. And I mean, we just kind of dug into it immediately and started working together on set lists, had Bevis come by the schools, come meet the kids. And also introduce them to Bob Durham, who's, you know, the owners of our franchise schools. And, you know, he, Bevis hit it off with Bob, and the three of us have become somewhat chummy. And then we just started just rocking away at this curriculum, man. And it's really more just to kind of expand the curriculum of School of Rock and really kind of dig in more of the roots of rock and roll and kind of where rock and roll came from. And some pieces that were really, from our observation, missing from the School Rock curriculum. You know, it wasn't, there was like maybe one Jimi Hendrix song
right
in the playlist that the kids right were playing. So, you know, there was stepping that needed to be, you know, addressed and kind of looked at a little more. But, you know, that's kind of where we start off. Like I said, Jen introduced us and we just started working on this initiative. And, at School Rock, you know, if, for people that don't know what School Rock is, it's funny because people are like, what do you do at School of Rock? I'm like, School of Rock. But, you know, it's performance-based music education. You know, it's different than how we grew up or most musicians in Austin have learned how to play music, which is, you know, learn to play scales on the guitar, drum, you know, rudiments and stuff like that. We kind of approach it as a song first method, to where we teach the kid the song first and then the theory kind of comes later. You know, we just kind of dig right into like having a good time playing
that's
a
great
tune.
Yeah. That's, and great, you know, and because that's the thing that's discouraging. Like I took guitar lessons as a kid for a year before I wanted to.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
And I remember taking drum lessons, you know, for years, you know, Flamadiddles, Rudiments, you know, Paradiddles. I'm like, man, when are we going to play Guns N' Roses? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we actually give the kids what we probably wanted back in the day. It was just really just, we just want to play, you know, it's just, we're going to play Green Day. Let's just get into it. So, but the theory, you know, the song first method really is kind of the theory comes later. So, you know, we're learning how to play an AC/DC song. You know, once you learn the song, as we're learning the guitar solo, like, hey man, you know, by the way, this guitar solo has a pentatonic scale in it. So the theory kind of comes later once they're kind of into like playing music, and we just kind of dive into the song part. So, you know, going back to kind of how we kind of got working with Bevis, it was really more to kind of, like, a lot of the songs the kids were playing were like, you know, Seven Nation Army by White Stripes and, you know, just regular rock songs. So, you know, we thought it would be important not only to, you know, teach these kids these new, you know, songs in the song first method, but also kind of tell the history of kind of like, why don't we play some songs that were school, where rock and roll actually first started, with artists like Robert Johnson and Etta James and stuff like that. I mean, Hound Dog by Elvis Presley was, you know, first covered by Big Mama Thornton, and, you know, in little, Pat Boone was doing Little Richard, you know, Wop Bop a Lou Bop, a really bad version of that. But, so, you know, just I definitely want to let Bevis talk a little bit more on kind of how we, you know, we kind of dug into this curriculum, because he has a company that he's been working on with his sister. And, you know, just go ahead and, why don't you go ahead and talk about that a little bit, Bevis?
Okay. Well, you know, we're all friends here, Alex and, Johnny. So, I mean, I want to basically just take a little bit deeper dive than I normally would, even in like standard television media, since we have a little bit of time. I just think it's really pertinent for you to understand how much I appreciate you giving us a platform to really share the development of this concept, because it was an organic enterprise. It started out back in 2020. And I'm going to loosely just say around the month of May, I got outreached from Rick Carney from School of Rock. And he made an attempt to try to get me to understand that the corporate body had initiated a program that was, I suppose, that was supposed to basically amplify like the historical relevance of the Black influence in rock music, and was seeking, you know, a pathway to a curriculum that they could, you know, collaborate on and implement into their educational infrastructure. So that's how I first became in aware of and in conversations with Rick. So from May until about September of 2020, we started, you know, a series of conversations that were predicated on the key objective of the initiative. And
what's the initiative?
Because, well, because they approached me
What is the initiative?
Their initiative was to basically amplify awareness of Black culture.
Okay. Just making sure.
Towards the, you know, culmination of the rock and roll genre.
Right.
But what I'm sharing with you is that their outreach came in the middle of the George Floyd uprisings.
Right.
Because at that point in time, you may recall that there was a prolific number of corporate bodies that were expressing allegiance with Black Lives Matter, right? And you start to see that term, allies, you know, pop up in the context of like corporate advertising, mm-hmm. right? And you saw a lot of hashtags for Black Lives Matter everywhere. And being a Black individual, it really did smack of opportunism. It really did seem superficial, to be honest with you. You know, it didn't strike the average Black individual with a sense of authenticity, right? It seemed like a marketing ploy.
Right.
So when I had the engagement with Rick, the first thing that I addressed with him was basically like, well, you know, from the outside, this looks like a matter of convenience. And I'm not particularly interested in being involved in a situation that's just for optics, right? So after, you know, we had an opportunity to have a meaningful conversation, he understood that I wasn't going into this conversation just half-cocked, right?
Right.
My feeling about it was more power to the School of Rock, you know, for teaching kids education, because there was a dearth of educational opportunity in public school systems. It's not the same way that it was in the 60s when I was a kid growing up. It was routine for, you know, public school systems, especially like late elementary and early middle school. You had to try to play something, whether you had any talent or not. And if you really didn't possess any particular musical ability, you wound up playing triangles or clavis, you know, and because it just had to be a situation where you had exposure. But this was the way that they recognized very early on whether an individual had musical proclivities. So in the case of what Rick was approaching me with, I asked him, well, how did you even get my name? And he said, well, we originally reached out to the Black Rock Coalition office in New York City, and they referred you to us because you were already here in Austin and because you were a foundational member of that organization. They knew me well, and they spoke highly of my, you know, ability to coordinate, you know, projects. So long story short, we got the ball rolling in conversation, and after several months, it became kind of clear that they were looking for a third party entity to partner with that was basically an academic system with a vetted academician of a PhD caliber, right? To provide ethnomusicology, you know, as the foundation of this curriculum that they wanted to embrace. And when they did, you know, a cursory exploration online, they couldn't find a system that was already in existence. So I told them, you know, that I would build one. And I was already in a running relationship with an academician from George Mason University named Dr. Thomas Stanley, who was helping me develop my autobiography as a co-writer. So he and I already had a relationship. And then serendipitously, my younger sister, Stephanie, née Griff, is a retired municipal director. In other words, she was the director for the city of Santa Monica for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And she was an expert, you know, in executive administrative processes. Because of COVID, she had to postpone two projects that she was already engaged in. And because she had a vacuum, you know, of inactivity, she offered to partner with me to kind of establish the foundation of Duvois Apex Solutions. So she and I are respectively the CEO and the CFO of this educational concept. And the first thing that we offered to the School of Rock as a product was a 40-year timeline that clearly articulated how the era of big band swing mutated into small band ensembles that we were considered as jump blues styles, with people like Louis Jordan at the forefront of that. And they were like the precursor to the first, quote unquote, you know, rock and roll ensembles, because in the 40s, big band was the predominant music. It was the predominant pop music. It was the music that everyone socialized to and danced to, so to speak, even before the days of television, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time you get into the late 40s and early 50s, what had happened was the swing music had become so popular across the country that smaller organizations like university sororities and fraternities wanted to have hire smaller bands that they could afford, you know, to come and entertain. And that's how the formation of the so-called jump blues style of presentation came into being. So by the same token, you also had a proliferation of like traveling gospel artists like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And where she played into the equation was that she was literally like the first person to hire Little Richard when he was a teenager. So she had Little Richard on her, you know, touring program when he was 14 years old. So she's the first person that gave Little Richard exposure. So fast forward, you know, to the era of the early 50s, Little Richard basically obviously surfaced as one of the first legitimate, like, breakout rock and roll stars, you know, from Louisiana, right? And so when you're looking at it in terms of just, say, an influential timeline, you have to understand that Louis Jordan was like the seminal influence that inspired Chuck Berry.
Right.
Without Louis Jordan, theoretically, there wouldn't have been a Chuck Berry, because Louis Jordan was the prototype. Chuck Berry was actually brought into Chess Records by Muddy Waters, right? Because the blues was like the predominant pop music prior to the emergence of the rock and roll genre, right? And so Chess Records had Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, you know, Little Walter.
Right.
And people like that, and Jimmy Reed, and of course, you know, by then you start to see the ascension of like B.B. King out of the South, you know, out of Memphis, right? So it was just a gradual migration, you know, a gradual sea change, you know, the same way that you look at the idea of the development between like punk rock into quote unquote new wave, how those things kind of like preceded or kind of stair-stepped one another, right? So we fast forward all the way up to 2021. By now, we've got like a full-blown, you know, staff for Duvois Apex Solutions. We call the company Divas for short, right? So Divas had a full-blown organization with like Luke Jacobs as a production coordinator, Fumihito Sujiwara, you know, as a graphic designer with us, you know, and then Dr. Stanley and myself as writers, you know. And my sister Stephanie as the administrative executive.
Well, let's get into the program. Let's tell me what the program is and what it is that you guys are implementing, and it's called the Deep Roots of Rock and Blues.
Yeah, take it, Alex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing we started off with was really kind of just looking at, you know, for once again going back to School of Rock and kind of how we do stuff. There's the kids learn certain songs, right? And then we have themes. So a theme will be punk rock. A theme will be songs from movies. A theme will be, so these bands basically learn, you know, a set of like 10 songs, and then we'll go play a show. We'll book a show at Antone's or something and go play these songs on stage. These kids play the songs. So one of the sets that we created with Bevis that he helped curate was a set called The Evolution of Blues. And it was really kind of introducing songs into the curriculum that we really didn't have in our regular song curriculum.
Right.
And it was, once again, the songs from Robert Johnson, Etta James. We have some Howlin' Wolf songs in there. I'm kind of really just kind of telling the story of blues music. And that's one of them. That's one of many that we will do eventually. You know, we have another one. We'll do Motown and soul classics and stuff like that. But that is the curriculum. That's kind of where we started at was with just really kind of diving in to the songs that were being learned in the schools. And, you know, that's kind of the beginning of it.
Right. And it's funny because you and me grew up on music that was steeped in blues. And you might have been listening to a Led Zeppelin record that had an actual blues song on it. You know what I mean? But you thought it was a Led Zeppelin song and you had no idea. And it was like, I didn't really know who Robert Johnson was till I was like, you know, 24 or something. You know what I mean? I mean, I knew the name kind of, but I had no idea what, you know, what it was.
Yeah, and I've been listening to that, you know, unbeknownst to them. I mean, even Elvis had a steep, you know, appreciation of black artists that he was covering. The Rolling Stones, the first few albums were all black artists, you know. So, yeah. I mean, this were being introduced in our homes, you know, without, you know, no, as young, you know, kids in America, not really knowing kind of where this came from. But, you know, I think it's going back to Bevis's point of just really teaching the kids, you know, where this music came from. I think that's kind of, and finding a fun way to do it. Cause I mean, they're young. I mean, so, you know, it's really introducing them and then showing them the songs. And also as they learn these songs and they get older, really kind of digging into kind of who this artist was, you know, the cultural significance of this artist and the impact that they actually had on blues music and rock and roll music. So, I mean, you know, finding a fun way to do it. And, you know, and the great thing about School of Rock is that, especially with the pandemic going on and everything, I mean, you know, that performance-based music education and getting these kids in a room together and having a musical conversation has really been therapeutical for them as far as, you know, getting back out of their house, man, and playing together and being together and playing music. So it's been a really healthy, and they're having a great time with these songs. I mean, and learning shuffles and stuff like that. And Bevis can speak a little bit more on this, but for him, it's more important that they learn feel, which was another thing that I think we weren't really paying attention of like how a song feels and that emotion, you know, finding that emotion within a song. And I think blues and these, you know, Motown songs are a great way to kind of introduce that into the curriculum too. So,
right. Bevis, like, did you, like, when you were a kid, like, how did you find out about those guys? Like, did you hear the Rolling Stones first, or did you hear Muddy Waters first?
I heard the real stuff first.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, because you recall I told you I grew up in L.A.?
Right, right.
And you recall I told you my dad was a barber?
Right.
And I told you my dad's barbershop was adjacent to the 5-4 Ballroom, which was a blues club.
Right, so you got the first hand.
All the clients were my dad's friends. They were all blues musicians, like Bobby Bland and, you know, Ike Turner and, you know, people like, Johnny Otis, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so it's like these guys were just my dad's buddies, cronies, you know, because my dad had a little gambling operation in the back of his shop. So these musicians would come over after their sets and whatnot and gamble their resources, right? Because it was just part and parcel. They come in the daytime to get sharp, to get shaved up, and get their, you know, hair processed and all the things that, you know, entertainers need. And then after the show, they double back because my dad had an after hours situation, you know.
Right.
You know what I mean? Where these guys would just socialize. So for me, before I entered formal school, before I went to like the first grade, I spent afternoons at my dad's barbershop. He was like my daycare. And these musicians were there every day. And he had a jukebox and they put up a little stool because I could already read. I had an aunt that taught me to read before I went to first grade. So I could read song titles on a jukebox. And I just was like the DJ of the barbershop. So all I listened to was, you know, you know, Roy Brown and Ray Charles and Bobby Bland and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Bo Diddley and all that stuff. And Bo Diddley was probably one of my favorites, you know. But also you have to put in context, Johnny, I was born in 53. So by the time I was five, it was 58, right? And about the time you're five, that's when you really start to absorb your surroundings and everything. You really become cognizant.
Right.
Back in the 50s, that's when the American Bandstand first started. You know what I mean? On television. That's back in the days when there was only three TV networks and TV ended at midnight. So anytime you saw a musician on television, it was like a big thing, right?
Yeah.
And especially at that period, the rock and roll stars were hitting like mainstream TV hard. So you are seeing, you know, Little Richard and seeing Chuck Berry and seeing Bo Diddley and Fats Domino and those guys, right? Along with Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley. And Elvis Presley obviously was, you know, the next sea change. He was like, because he was the crossover artist, right? He was the white artist that crossed over, right? From the segregated marketing of the rock and roll music. But once those acts really started touring coast to coast, you have to also remember it was a pretty severe civil rights challenge because especially in the South, the audiences were still being segregated, right? And it was black people on in the balcony or on one side of the audience separated by a rope,
right?
Or by a, you know, police line. But the music was the thing that transcended all of that. So this is where I'm going back to my initiative of wanting to be involved with the School of Rock, because I'm not looking at it strictly from a musical standpoint. I'm looking at it from a social standpoint. The idea of teaching like young white music students, right, the importance of the vitality of black culture and just how deep it goes into the DNA of popular music, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
More so, there's a binary conversation that I'm trying to open up with like the corporate body of School of Rock to show that, first of all, there's a little bit of prohibitive stratification in your price points. In other words, it's fine for me to teach quote unquote affluent white kids about black culture, but what's the point of that if they don't get to play with any black kids, or if they don't get to play with any Hispanic kids, or if they don't get to play with any Native American or Asian kids? Because the majority of the single parent households in the United States can't afford that. You see where we're at economically, right? I mean, like with the price of gas, only going to get worse.
Yeah, just a quick aside. Just before we had this conversation, I went and bought dog food, and it went up $8 since the last time I bought dog food. It went up $8.
Boom.
A bag.
And that's real dollars.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's real dollars.
Yeah.
So the way that Bobby and I and Alex are really looking at this, we're not looking at it from a fiscal standpoint, right? It's like a social experiment
for
us. It's like my thing is the School of Rock is a great teaching platform. You know, I have no aspersions or no disrespect whatsoever for the School of Rock as an entity, right? But where they have room for improvement, right, is the fact that if you take this platform and open up just another tier of engagement, you know, so that lesser funded households can participate, now you're really driving social change. Because now you have students interacting from different social stratas, right? And different cultural backgrounds, right? And kids don't really need to sit there and parse out, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg in the 21st century, bro. I mean, we're still talking about this nonsense and we're struggling with voting rights in the 21st century. I don't really want kids. I mean, if I had a child, I wouldn't want my kid mired in that conflagration of political discourse. You know what I'm saying? I want kids moving and grooving socially together, working on something beautiful, which is always the creative benefit, right? When you're working on something with a buddy,
right,
you accomplish it together, there's a high five, and you can't really put a price tag on that. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
And my feeling, if Austin is the so-called progressive mecca that it purports itself to be, right, since we have every social media giant, it's got a tower, you know, yeah. tower of, you know, building yeah, yeah. structure downtown, yeah. right? It's like, well, what are we doing at the grassroots? What's the point of having $1 billion of, you know, fiscal assets flowing through this city if it's not trickling down, you know what I'm saying, to the right. to the general population and especially to the proletariat?
So let me ask you this. So you're having underprivileged children of color able to have a lower price to go
that's
to school
our goal.
Abroad? Okay, that's your goal.
That's our
okay.
goal.
And that's I'll great, let, man. I'll let that's Alex, incredible.
I'll let Alex jump back in on that because I'm not trying to.
Yeah, because I'm sure also there's a practical sort of like, I mean, I've seen you, Alex. I mean, for those of you, I mean, those of you that listening that don't know, Alex and I work with artists and the artists in the Austin Music Foundation together, and we've been friends for over 25 years. And yeah. so I know that we all struggled with 2020, like losing so much income. And wasn't that when you guys were opening the South Park Meadows branch?
Like, yeah, we actually opened it. Yeah, I mean, it was grand opening, grand closing. Like, it was literally, you know, we opened it. I think we opened in January, and then here comes the, you know, 2 months later comes the pandemic, and we had to shut down. But we went remote. I mean, we survived
right.
going remotely, as did Austin Music Foundation and many other companies. But you know, we went remote, and that kept us above our heads above water. But yeah, I mean, it was a really, really hard way to open, but we're in a good spot now. And then bringing Bevis into the fold to kind of like enrich our curriculum. It's been awesome. And going back to his statement, I mean, really at the end of the day, we want the kids to have a good time, but also learn some kind of, you know, history through it. You know, and it's no different than us having a band, right? I mean, we've always said, like, if you're not going to have fun playing a band, why be in a band? I mean,
right. Yeah.
But, so, you know, but that, I think that that's kind of like, we want to trickle that down into the kids and how they perform. Cause I mean, one thing at School of Rock, we're not only just teaching them how to play music. We're teaching them how to become good people and people that can work together and be team players.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what color you are, and this is something that you'll use through your whole life. You know, when you work in that cubicle with your coworker, you know, that you're going to have to learn how to work with that person too. So I feel like School of Rock is more than just the music. I mean, when we hire our instructors, we're like, that's great that you're a good musician, man. But like the other half is like, can you inspire these kids? Can you connect with them? Can you challenge them to put them on that next level?
Right. You know, I mean, right. Really yeah. Important. Yeah. I'll go back to my own first teacher was not an engaging, like I couldn't get out of there fast. Even when I wanted to learn, I didn't want to be there. Okay. No yeah, offense would, against the poor fired. Lady.
The guy would be fine. But yeah, no. So, I mean, we, and you know, and to speak a little bit more on kind of our goals for reaching the underserved community, that's, you know, that's the next thing. I mean, the first thing was really kind of digging into the songs and the curriculum and what we're teaching. And, you know, it's not only teaching the kids, I mean, it's teaching the instructors, because the instructors are the ones who are going to teach the kids. So
right.
it's almost kind of like going back to the teachers and really getting them caught up. And a lot, you know, some of them are young, some of them are older. Some of them remember these songs, some of them have never heard of it. So it's a new lesson to them as well. But it's important that, you know, the teachers are the ones who have to really, you know, that we've really been working with on this as well. So, okay. But as far as, you know, speaking to the underserved community, that's kind of the next step and kind of what we plan on doing, as far as like finding ways, you know, obviously with Bob, we're finding ways to do, you know, give away free summer camps and stuff like that to kid underserved communities. But, you know, even further than that, going to get, you know, donations from, you know, whether it's nonprofits or sponsorship deals, so we can go get a few $1,000, carve that up into some scholarship funds and go find kids in these underserved communities. And in some cases go to them. I mean, cause you know, we can give these, as many kids as we want free lessons, but I mean, they can't even get to school. So, you know, we're going to find a way to go into these communities and where they can walk down the street and experience, you know, a School of Rock experience. So, you know, these are all things that we're working on. I mean, we're just now digging into this, and we got a little ways to go. And this is not something I've said this on a few interviews throughout this month that we've been doing this, but it's, you know, this is not something we just want to do for Black History Month. This is something that we feel strongly that should be a part of this curriculum moving forward. I mean, it's just should always be implemented and continue to grow. And I mean, the kids will just have so much more in their musical palette, you know, having this knowledge, I think.
Yeah. And you guys just did a show on Sunday at Antone's, right?
Yeah, we did a show at Antone's. We had Eve Monsey came up and played with the kids. Mike Buck got on the drums and played Sweet Home Chicago. Like, you know, I mean, crazy experiences. And the night before that, our house band in Round Rock opened up for Ruthie Foster at Hotspot. So,
I saw that. You know, yeah.
You know, we're not only giving, you know, them great opportunities, but, you know, through these shows and this curriculum. But, I always joke to the kids, like, I don't know if they don't know how good they got it. I mean, we never had this, you know. I remember Jackie Benson walking into the school like, man, where was this when I grew up?
You're right. We didn't have this, but we had something that was different that they don't have, which is like, we had like Bowie.
We just had to figure
like
it out.
In real time. You know what I mean? We had like Jagger in real time. Like, do you know what I mean? Like we had these heroes, and that's the one thing about, I noticed that in rock, it seems like there's a certain era of rock that starts in the time, Bevis, that you're talking about in like the 40s, late 30s, whenever blues music started taking a turn, and then up to like maybe the 90s, and then kind of like rock has taken a different seat at the table. But that era of rock is probably the most listened to music, period. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I've got thoughts on that. And you and I certainly have, you know, probably similar sensibilities about it. I mean, I'm still a generation beyond you,
right,
Johnny.
Right.
Beyond you and Alex. So I just happen to have always been like a futurist. I've always been interested in like the new, so to speak. I've never considered myself like a classicist, so to speak. And that's been my entire sensibility from the time when I began in 1971, right? Like when I got to Austin and officially had a band that had an agency and started touring around the state of Texas and then eventually through the Midwest, which was Hatchet Talent. There were legitimately only about, I'm going to just be generous and say maybe 15 bands in the whole state that were really like, you know, noteworthy,
right,
because
right.
You had to carry a certain gravitas to the stage to get a gig. You couldn't just be mediocre to play. You had to have something that was really specific about you.
Right.
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 So I just use as an example, like when I was 17, 18, I was still green as a pool table. I mean, I just didn't know everything that I can espouse to you now. Right. I was still in a state of discovery. But the advantage that I did have that accelerated my acumen was that I was favored inside of the camp of Cracker Jack, which was kind of like the preeminent hard rock band in Texas.
Right.
Their only rival would have really been ZZ Top. You know what I'm saying? At that time, the early 70s.
Right.
Cracker Jack being Tommy Shannon and Uncle John Turner after they just left Johnny Winter.
Right.
So now I'm in what I call close proximity and direct communication with two guys that legitimately were superstars 2 years ago. Before, you know what I'm saying? Before they met me.
Right.
They were legitimately like signed to Columbia Records on tour with Led Zeppelin as their opening act.
Right.
Right. And these are guys that like rub shoulders with Jimi Hendrix all the time.
Right.
Who was kind of like my North Star. Right.
Right.
And so as mentors, I couldn't have been more fortunate because these guys were telling me basically like, look, you know, you can do this thing, right? But there's a right way and a half-assed way to go about it. If you want to go about it right, you got to practice, 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 right? Because it's one thing to be okay. It's another thing to be great. And in order to be great, you have to literally like live, eat, drink, and sleep your instrument until it becomes like a part of your body.
Right.
So that's the thing that really was instilled in me when I was 18. So by the time I was 22, I was sharp as a tack. You know what I mean? Because I had the whole picture. In other words, I had the discipline, I had the experience, and I had the style. And the style is always the most elusive factor. Like, how do you become like your own natural butterfly, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, you fake it till you make it. You know that expression, right?
Right, right.
And I emulated Jimi Hendrix and Sly Stone's dress, and then I started taking influences from Keith Richard, you know, and Rod Stewart, you know, and people like that, right? And whatever I considered to be hip. And then, of course, when David Bowie came up, that was another big sea change. It was like the next big thing since the Beatles, or literally the next big thing since Jimi Hendrix, right? It was like, to me, it was like the Beatles, James Brown, Jimi Hendrix, Sly and the Family Stone, and then like David Bowie, you know, it was like a big thing for Bevis Griffin.
Yeah.
Right. So by being able to kind of incorporate an amalgam of all of those different influences, I had something that I could work with as an entertainer. Right.
Right.
Just like years later, you would see that with Prince, or you'd see that, you know, to a degree with like Lenny Kravitz, right? Sure. What you're looking at is hybrids of influence manifested in a new persona.
Right.
Right. So what you're talking about now, let's just say as we get up into the 90s, right? I mean, to me, say what you will, once the whole thing became more dystopian and your rock stars were people like Marilyn Manson and Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To me, those guys, in effect, were really, to me, the last noteworthy rock stars, because they were so dangerous. Their image was so controversial. You know what I'm saying? And they were so comprehensive about their presentation, the way that they brought it, right? Because I'm from the era when Alice Cooper was like the world's most notorious villain in music.
Right.
Right? In the 70s, right? I remember that. Where I was going in this train of thought was, you know, what happened was as the advent of hip hop began to continue to surge forward, right? Once you got to the point to where you had like hip hop megastars, and I'm talking about from the time that, let's just say, Run DMC really made like a massive impact.
Right.
That kind of like blew the parameters of hip hop like wide open, right? Because Run DMC were working with hard rock music in their samples.
Right.
That really kind of was one of the factors that really kind of opened the gates, right? And of course, as things continued forward, and then you got to the era of like NWA, who were like way more controversial than the Sex Pistols.
Right.
Right. I mean, you can't get anything more punk rock than Fuck the Police. Right.
No. Yeah.
No. So my point is, once that took a foothold, and then, of course, you had the spinoffs like Ice Cube. And then, of course, as Dr. Dre came into prominence as a producer, and then you have the mass success of Snoop Dogg. And then now you're dealing with a cycle of mega stars, right? Snoop Dogg. And then you've got like Eminem, you know what I mean? Who's now like the Elvis of hip hop, right? Because here he comes, the so-called long shot, because, you know, there's always been like white rappers in the mix, you know what I'm saying? Like coming up, especially if you're on the East Coast, you know what I mean? But as far as having like a across the board international megastar like Eminem, for me, that was another sea change. That's like, okay, now the genie's all the way out the bottle. You dig what I mean?
Right, right.
And as things evolved and evolved and evolved, production sensibilities started to modulate, right? Because of the success of these great hip hop artists. And the production techniques that they were using started to become more frequently considered like the mainstream, right?
Right.
And so that trickled into the era of like even the boy bands, right? Like NSYNC and Boyz II Men, you know, I'm sorry, NSYNC and
Backstreet Boys.
Well, you know, Backstreet Boys. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like those production values were the thing that really started to drive to the front of rock music. Now, you always had your subgenres of heavy metal, right? You got your thrash bands, right? And then you got your gothic metal bands. And then you've got like your, you know, satanic metal bands out of Scandinavia. You know, the whole gamut of those subgenres started to surface. And then with the proliferation of the rock festivals, things started to become more genre specific or more compartmentalized with regard to, you know, the respect of each particular subgenre. Right. Well, look where we're at right now. Once we got to the era of, let's say, Spotify.
Yeah.
To where now you're not just browsing the crates of a record store at Best Buy or Tower Records, right? You're literally in an ocean of music.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, the way that they market it and promote it, the way that, you know, playlists come into fashion and this, that, or the other, people just have a curiosity to browse for new things. Right.
Right.
And so now it's gotten to a point to where on an international spectrum, like people underestimate like the impact of like Latin music, right? Like how Latin hip hop, Latin pop, you know what I'm saying? Right. I mean, ever since the days of La Vida Loca, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That whole thing was like a sea change, right? Because now you're looking at things from a broader global perspective, and how many Latin speaking people are there in the world, right?
Yeah.
Millions, right?
Yeah.
And that's my point. It's like we're moving into this era to where it's like we're looking at the waning of the male white supremacist paradigm of what is hip. You dig what I mean?
That's right.
That whole controversy that we got involved, when I got involved with the Black Rock Coalition, we were just progressive black musicians that were sick and tired of people telling us that Elvis Presley is the king of rock and roll. We're like, come on, man, really?
Yeah.
I was born at night, but not last night, right? You can't fade me like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then a few years later, you get Living Color, right? And they become like the spontaneous darlings of the media, because what are they? Oh, it's a unique black rock band.
right. Yeah.
They are a great, unique rock, black rock band, but you're forgetting that Fishbone was there 5 years before that.
Right.
And you're forgetting that the Bad Brains were there since like 1980.
And Death, you know, who you introduced me to.
Well, then Death, that's a miracle story, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, nobody really knew about that until they resurfaced in 2010.
Yeah.
Right? On the backside of the internet, right? That's a miracle story in itself. Well, my point is, just like you discovered Death, right? How many, there's people that will never hear of me unless they're hearing about me through the conversation or the lens, you know, of another enterprise. They'll hear about me in what I call a reflexive content, right? I mean, I should have known about Death in real time in 1974, 1975, because I was active.
Right?
But there's no internet, and neither one of us was signed to a major label. And since if you're not in the media, then you don't exist. It's like that sort of situation. So where we are in real time is that it's very difficult to find anything that's unique, because everything is like a degree of, to, I'm just saying this with all due respect, everything has been appropriated to the point to where it's like it's copies of imitations. And there's a word I use for that called simulacra, right? It's like everything has been hybridized down to a low common denominator.
Right.
So anything that you were to show me, like I remember there was a band that popped up a few weeks ago on Saturday Night Live from Rome called Monasque.
And they spell their
name, and it looks like Manskin, but it's
Manasque.
It's like a a Portuguese word. And it's pronounced Monasque.
Yeah,
dude, I'm begging.
But what I saw was a band that was like dressed in fly ass hip designer clothes, right? That kind of sounded like T-Rex.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And to me, I'm going like, that was just instant appeal. So I just jump on my iPhone and type in, you know, man skin and get back the fact that these guys are like a award-winning band of like some one of the most prestigious awards that you can get, like in Europe, for being like the songwriters of the year. Uh-huh. And they're they're Italian.
You did Euro song.
Yeah. Yeah. So my point is, if they had not been on Saturday Night Live, they probably not would have caught my attention unless somebody literally phoned me or pulled my coat or sent me a link.
Right.
You dig?
Yeah.
And of course, these are the days that we live in.
Yeah. Well, so, let's get back to the program, back to the School of Rock, the deep roots of rock and blues. So that is that's a program that people can sign up for, or is that program now instilled in just the general curriculum?
Alex?
Yeah, no, it's basically, you know, you're signing up for School of Rock, and that curriculum is, you know, just included as part of, you know, being a student at School of Rock. So, and, you know, and if anybody's looking, listening, you know, if they want to get themselves, I mean, we have adult band as well. So, you know, ages 8 to 80, but, you know, you can find us on schoolofrock.com. And you'll find, you know, within the website, you'll be able to see, you know, choose which school you're closest to, whether you're closer to South Park Meadows or Round Rock. And then obviously there's a, you know, Rick Carney School on Anderson Lane in Austin. So, you know, there's three locations in the Austin area that they can go check out, and, you know, but the ones that are actually really working on this curriculum are going to be the South Park and Round Rock schools.
Okay. Perfect. So, it's great to talk to you guys. And you guys have more shows planned or not yet?
We always have shows planned. You know, I think the next ones we're looking at are, you know, at, Seaboys and Far Out Lounge and, you know, a few down the road, but yeah, we're always booking shows. That's kind of like the plan between the kids learn the set list and then we go book a show and we get them on stage. And I mean, that's another experience in itself. You know, it's just feeling that audience reaction, you know, aside from just playing on stage together. So, but yeah, just, you know, go to our website, schoolofrock.com. And, you know, that has just like a band. We're just like a band. So has all our dates and, you know, when we're going to be playing in the area soon.
That's great. I wanted to let you guys know my cousin, who's like my age, has a son that's, in his early teens and has some difficulty, autism is what he has. And he went to School of Rock and he's really done well in it. He's really excelled at music. And I know that, that these are great things for kids that like, it's a great thing for like it's been proven in a lot of studies that music and learning music at a formidable age helps you learn other things better too.
Yeah, no, it does, man. You know, and we've worked with autistic students and, you know, my experience of working with autistic students is really showing them, you know, School Rock's a great method. We're like, here's the chords to, you know, AC/DC or here's the drum beat. And they really work well off of like watching someone else play it as opposed to like trying to, hey, let's read these notes off a piece of paper. But, it's amazing what it does with the kids. And man, it's been my greatest joy working with School of Rock, just to see these kids thrive and grow, you know, within the school after they've been there a few years. So, I mean, it's a great thing. And, you know, another, you know, I also want to add, Bevis is a, let me see, he's Bevis at Bevis. Your website is dvasolutions.org.
It's dvasolutions.org for Duhois Apex Solutions.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's on here.
Check out what they're doing. Yeah.
And I'll give you just a closing statement if I can. In other words, the core objective that we are undertaking here is bringing, you know, cultural awareness to a young student body that has the opportunity to basically assimilate those facts and move with an elevated sense of dignity and respect as peers, right? My thing is pigment may describe what you look like, but it doesn't define who you are. And we're striving to develop unity through diversity, through the assistance of the School of Rock.
That's awesome. Well,
beautifully said.
Yeah, beautifully said. Unity Thank through you so diversity. Much, Dude, I love you guys. You're doing great work. And everyone get out there, check out dvasolutions.org. And if you want to get more involved with School of Rock, go to schoolofrock.com. South Park Meadows and Round Rock are the ones that are doing the Deep Roots of Rock and Blues program. Hopefully the rest of them will pick up soon. Dudes, great talking to you.
Always a pleasure, love Johnny. You guys. Thank you so much. We really appreciate
you. Yeah, man.
Really appreciate your support.
Thanks, yeah, Johnny. Appreciate we love you, man.
Appreciate you guys out there doing this. See you, bros.
Spread the word.
I can do the math. What's the lesson? Where we are, where we've been, where we at, what it do, where we headed to right now.
That's Alex Vallejo and Bevis Griffin. You can find Bevis Griffin at dvasolutions.org, and you can find School of Rock at schoolofrock.com. South Park Meadows and Round Rock are the centers that are doing the Deep Roots of Rock and Blues program. All right. I want to thank those guys for coming on. Love them both. Love those dudes. Love talking to them. Love shooting the shiz with those bros. With those bros. All right, gang. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Don't forget that you can go to schoolofrock.com, find Devois Apex Solutions at dvasolutions.org. And don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts. New shows all the time. New shows on Tuesdays and Fridays mostly. But we're doing 3 shows a week every once in a while, even next week, right? Yeah, stay tuned. New shows. Find us wherever it is you listen to podcasts. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Thank you so much for listening to the show. I want to thank Alex and Bevis for sitting down and taking the time. Have a great week, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
Trying to make it make sense, find a cure, find a cause, find a meaning for it all. Take it moment to moment, stay shoulder to shoulder. Supposed to make it the most, cause when it's over, it's over. Live in the mix, trying to thrive and exist. All aboard the mothership, baby, one way trip. It's a million opinions, like a million opinions. In the end, they drops in the mist. Let me tell you this, top.